And our sermon text today is Ecclesiastes 4, 1 through 16. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead, who are already dead, more fortunate than the living, who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not yet seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?" This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two be together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who came later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is a vanity and a striving after wind. Koheleth reviews a variety of evils under the sun today. That's our title today, Variety. A variety of evils under the sun. This is a real brace of classic wisdom literature today. Very proverbial in its nature, right? Some short, sweet proverbs. Very few people have an idea as to how brief the window of liberty is open to humanity. We're talking about oppression in part today. Most of our history as a fallen race is characterized by tyranny and oppression, as Koheleth will reaffirm for us in our text. From the moment that Lamech uttered, "I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 70-fold. A braggart of tyranny. Men have been tyrannizing over one another ever since. The Egyptian dynasties are some of the earliest examples of tyranny of the few over the many. Israel served the pharaohs for generations before being liberated by the God of the Bible. Assyria, Babylon, Rome serve as further prototypes of the satanic oppression of which John Milton wrote in his Paradise Lost. He said, "So spoke the fiend of his opponents to God, and with necessity, the tyrant's plea excused his devilish deeds." The tyrant's plea, necessity. It was of necessity that the British oppressed the colonies. Lord Granville, George III, and his parliament passed measures like the Stamp Act and the Quartering Act because it was necessary to bring the colonies to heel. They closed Boston Harbor because it was necessary to make them pay for the Boston Tea Party. On and on. Yet we Americans asserted our English liberties the more the English asserted their tyrannical rule. Edmund Burke observes this about necessity. He says, necessity is the plea for every infringement of human liberty. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. Necessity. Keep that in mind the next time lockdowns come around. Our founders were rebels from principle. They established those principles in documents like our Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, our Constitution, even the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. Yet most people don't know what these documents are, much less what they mean to our liberty and freedom. And that brief window of liberty and freedom is fast closing. Ronald Reagan said famously, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same. Or one day we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States where men were free. Unquote. I'm afraid this is the destiny of most men. Unlike liberty, tyranny is passed on in the bloodstream. Daniel Defoe put it this way. He says, nature has left this tincture in the blood that all men would be tyrants if they could. Huh. And I think Koheleth would give his hearty assent to this truth. We see this reflected for us in verses 1 through 3. You have a brief outline on the inside flap of your bulletin if you want to follow along with us. And in verses 1 through 3, Koheleth asserts that amongst the profuse evils under the sun, the oppression of the weak by the strong is enough to make one weep. It's no wonder that tears flow over the default setting of man towards oppression and tyranny. Behold, the tears of the oppressed, he said, and they had no one to comfort them. Koheleth observes the perennial state of man, all the oppressions that are done under the sun. Those particular enumerated oppressions are many, too, articulated by the prophets. For example, Jeremiah 7 exhorts Israel, if you do not oppress, the same Hebrew word used here, if you do not oppress the sojourner, the fatherless, or the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own harm, then I will let you dwell in this place. Koheleth has every reason to consider his own people, the Israelites, in this matter. Solomon himself is only the third king out from Israel's craven flight from liberty to tyranny. We see in 1 Samuel chapter 8, Samuel laments this. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. Appoint for us a king to judge us like all the other nations. Previously, they had enjoyed liberty and freedom under their true king, Yahweh Elohim. They had a representative form of government in a tribal republic with appeal to judges. But this was not good enough. They looked out at the nations surrounding them and saw that they were different, a curiosity, and in some cases a laughingstock. Who will lead you out to war, they would say, characteristically, your choir, right? Or some bearded judge in a robe with a staff? Look at us. We have mighty kings in glistening armor with a sword. He sits on a glorious throne, and all the nations around pay respect. They kiss his ring. He makes them an offer they can't refuse. This is what Israel wanted too, in the end. Do you think Solomon didn't see this? Already this third generation king was executing what Yahweh warned them would happen, right, through the voice of Samuel. He'll draft your children into his service. The sons for the army, the daughters to serve in his kitchens. He'll take the best land for himself. These tyrants will take a tenth of all you have in tax, if only that was all that was taken from us, right? It's estimated that with hidden taxes, taxes up to 40% of your income is taken in taxes. They'll seize the best of your flocks and draft animals. What was the result? Samuel said, you will cry out because of your kings whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Well, that day had arrived. Though Solomon himself was administering a soft tyranny, we know from the record in Kings and Chronicles that his sons, despite having this book before them at their elbow, his sons would be hard tyrants. Right? Rehoboam, what did he say? Whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Truly, the kings subsequent to Solomon were precisely as characterized here. On the side of the oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. Behold the tears of the oppressed, with no one to comfort them. Cry me a river. Rivers of tears have been cried over oppressors ever since. Robert Herrick puts it this way, "Twixt kings and tyrants there is this difference known. Kings seek their subjects' good, tyrants their own." There is no one in our day more oppressed than trafficked women and children at the border. Many subjects of oppression we could touch on today, but one that is little remarked on and blithely ignored by the American public are those women and children who are trafficked at the border. A Homeland Security Inspector General's report that was released Monday, tomorrow will be a week since it's been released, says that the Biden-Harris administration has lost track of over 320,000 migrant children. Think of that. 320,000 migrant children lost track of who have crossed the border. The report says untold numbers of children are now at risk of sex trafficking, forced labor, and other forms of exploitation. So reports the New York Post. Behold your federal government oppressors. We are being ruled by evil men and women. Catherine Austin Fitz, who is a currency expert, she has a great website, by the way, and so she knows this subject very well. Catherine Austin Fitz tells us, she says, slavery is now, always has been, and always will be the most profitable venture in the world. That's true in the past, it's true now, and it will be in the future. She says the only reason it stops is when it's made less profitable than other options. Things like a civil war, right? William Wilberforce, of course, put an end to the slavery trade in England, with help from Parliament, but it was only because it became less profitable than other ventures because of the roadblocks put in the way by Parliament. And, of course, our Civil War was a major hiccup in the slave trade, but it hasn't ended. Slavery is not obsolete. It is not a relic of the past. It is happening in America right now. It hasn't stopped. Or across the world, either, for that matter. Do you hear the tears of the oppressed, the wails and cries of the oppressed? We have had some contact in the past. We've had Matt Smith from Operation Shield. It's his mission to minister to and to help trafficked women and children. And he's been, he says it's like trying to take a sip from a fire hose, getting the information across to people. And we're going to have more contact with Matt Smith in the future, I hope, and more contact with Operation Shield. The tears of the oppressed, do you hear their cries? Well, point two, a variety of evils under the sun. And verse four, amongst the profuse evils under the sun, the competition from envy to keep up with the Trumps is ever so fleeting. Keeping up with it, not the Joneses, but the Trumps we do in our own day, do we not? Well, Koheleth has extolled the virtues and encouraged us to relish the fruits of our labor, hasn't he? As brief as they may be, as vaporous as they may be. And he has also encouraged us to labor. And this theme keeps reoccurring, keeps coming back around, doesn't it? But lurking in the dark recesses of the human heart is this motive from envy. All toil and all skill come from a man's envy of his neighbor. All toil and all skill come from envy of man's of his neighbor. We see this all through Scripture. Saul, for example, was consumed by envy. When he heard Saul has slain his thousands, David's his tens of thousands, it drove him crazy, didn't it? Tried to pin David against the wall with a spear because of it. Herod wanted to build like Caesar Augustus. Remember, Caesar Augustus said, "I found Rome brick and I left it marble." Herod was envious of the Caesars and wanted to copy them and build. It benefited Israel in the long run. Julius Caesar wept on his 33rd birthday, because by age 33, Alexander the Great had conquered the whole world, and him, he was only a mere consul in Rome. Envy. Soon after the construction began on the first Trump Tower, this was when Donald Trump was a lowly, modest billionaire, but he was building Trump Tower back in 1979. The owners of Amway International, have you heard of Amway? Perhaps you've had one of their salesmen on your couch for a couple of hours, right? You couldn't wait to get the guy out of there, right? Well, Rich DeVos and Jay Van Andel of Amway International have built a multi-million dollar system, Ponzi scheme, some call it. But with their millions of dollars in my hometown, Grand Rapids, Michigan, they bought the old, storied Pantland Hotel, where I worked at the time, getting my way through college. And the Van Andel and DeVos owners bragged that they were going to transform this lowly hotel. It would be the Trump Tower of West Michigan. Well, it is now a glistening tower of glass and steel that dominates the city skyline, if you've ever driven into Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, I don't know if envy prompted them to do it. They surely compared themselves to Trump. They were looking for places to invest their millions, but it was the beginning of a revitalization of the whole dilapidated downtown of Grand Rapids. And it's unrecognizable now. And it also helped put this poor college student through school. I never got a paycheck from a poor man, but these rich men sure cut me paychecks all through my college career. How much of human behavior is ruled by envy, huh? Well, is all labor literally toil motivated by envy? I don't think so. I don't think he's trying to say that. Solomon is speaking proverbially. Again, proverb is like a marble, isn't it? It's a hard thought understanding that quickly given to us. Solomon is speaking proverbially. As his advice concerning the fool is, he says, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself." And then the very next proverb says, "Answer a fool according to his folly." lest he be wise in his own eyes. Oh, those two are juxtaposed, are they not? Well, how do you decide? It is wisdom that makes the decision, isn't it? If you're wise, you'll use the apt response in the apt situation. In fact, that's the theme of the next two Proverbs, which brings us to point number 3, verse 5. Variety. We're doing a brief review of a variety of evils under the sun. Amongst the profuse evils under the sun, the sloth of the foolish man is enough to make him a withered self-cannibal. Oh, vivid, graphic proverbs, are they not? This is precisely the kind of self-consumptive sloth about which he speaks here. It is a biological reality that the unfed body, when it's out of fuel, will begin to consume himself. Imagine a man so fat and lazy that he can't get up to work and his body begins consuming itself. First begins with fat, the body does, then muscle, and sometimes both, right? It's the destiny of the sloth, one who refuses to labor or refuses to do the right labor, the apt labor, too. It's not only the destiny of individuals, but nations who practice the kind of sloth that we see, nurtured and fed by our government. There's a little known contributor to inflation, by the way. This brings me to this point, right? There's a little known contributor to inflation. We're talking a lot about inflation in this election cycle, aren't we? And it has gotten out of hand, out of control. But one of the major factors is the $5 trillion spent in COVID relief. $5 trillion in COVID relief. What a waste. No one would take a job. Remember those days? It wasn't very long ago. No one would take a job. They were getting a check from Uncle Sam. Government money, of course, if you don't know, undermines the motive to work. The old maxim, you get more of what you pay for. If you pay for poverty, you get more poverty, and that's precisely what happened. We borrowed money on the government tab, and now that tab is due in the form of inflation. So many of those who took government checks when they could have worked are now complaining about inflation. Isn't that ironic? Higher prices for everything, right? Directly caused by their free government checks. And now the bill is due. Well, what is the contrast? Does it mean we never relax, that we're always laboring, always working? Point number 4, encompassing verse 6. Once again, wisdom discerns. But when the apt time and situation obtains. Amongst the profuse evils under the sun, verse 6, abundance attended with anxiety is worse than simplicity attended with peace. Now, this is the same kind of contrast noted in the pair of Proverbs concerning the answer to a fool. Here, one could construe a contradiction in the advice that a handful of quietness, what a great expression, a handful of quietness, an expression for rest from labor, is better than work. But is it? Of course not. One of the operational principles in reading and applying wisdom literature is the use of wise judgment in discerning when to live the behavior exhorted in the wisdom literature. If you don't have that wisdom, pray for it. You'll never understand the Proverbs otherwise. Just as there's a time to hold one's tongue in the presence of a fool, so there's a time to speak in the presence of a fool, and the wise man will discern those proper moments. So too, there's a proper time for labor and a proper time for a handful of quietness. That sounds pretty nice right about now, right? A handful of quietness. Shall we take a time to meditate for a few? No. This is not the apt time for quietness, I think. But it is great when it's there, is it not? I encountered this phenomenon more often in the high-powered success circles in the Chicago area. when I first started in ministry, I labored there for 13 years. Many of these men were the Gordon Gekko, greed is good type, who ruined their marriages and never saw their kids. But they were men of wealth and reputation and success, until they shut the door behind them in my office and poured out their woes. And they often died lonely, disillusioned, and early. One of my mentors, as we were exiting the home of one such dying man, quipped, "I never heard a man say on his deathbed, 'I should have spent more time at the office.'" Have you? So don't necessarily spend more time at the office. Go home. Go home. Have a cup of tea with your wife. Play a game of backgammon. Go hiking or skiing with your kids. Bake some fresh bread. Open a bottle of red wine. I think I'd like to do that right about now. Maybe have a moment of quiet, a handful of quiet with some fresh bread. This is the underlying message of this text, okay? Wise men will know when to work and when to have a handful of quiet. Which brings us to point five and verses 7 through 12. We're reviewing a variety of evils under the sun. And these, by the way, once again, are vapors and temporary. There are some things that endure, right? Oppression endures. But many of these responses are vaporous, are they not? Amongst the profuse evils under the sun, labor and toil without companionship is a lonely, fruitless affair. Verses 7 through 12. This ought to make you go home and want to hug your wife and children and spend some time with them, right? What a poignant plea here for companionship. These verses, what a poignant plea for companionship. There's a place, there's a void in every human breast that no amount of anything other than another person will fill. Isn't that true? Huh? We need people. We're wired for companionship. A world full of career and wealth and acquisitions will never fill up that void, which can only be filled by another. A companion meet for you, as God told Adam when he gave him Eve. If you go up to Big Springs in Island Park, you'll find the remote, quaint little cabin of Little Johnny Socks. Anybody been there? Have you been there? If you're visiting in this region, it's worth taking a detour going up to Johnny Socks' cabin in Big Springs, Island Park. He was 5'4". A hermit who built a bark-on cabin, right? Leaving the bark on, you need to peel the bark off if you're gonna build with wood. But not Johnny, and he built it to his own custom size too. Guys like me have to duck when we go in the door. And he was a pioneer in this region back in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. A hermit, the Oxford English Dictionary defines a hermit as one who retires from society and lives in solitude, eschewing human contact. Very few are the people who can do this. And those perfect hermits are usually very ill people anyway. But not Johnny, not Johnny. In fact, many of the pictures in Johnny Sack's cabin, as you'll see if you go up there, show him with people. Those who came to visit him or use his skills to help build and settle Island Park. So not even Johnny Sacks was a hermit, strictly speaking. And the observed advantages to companionship are many, are they not? It leaves one to bequeath his estate, if you have a son or family, right? And once again, the idea of estate looms large in the book of Ecclesiastes. You are encouraged to build as an estate, as vaporous as it may be. Nevertheless, we're wired to do this. Companionship gives you one to bequeath your estate. It also means you've got help when you're in a jam, right? I've fallen and I can't get up. He uses that very illustration here, right? When you fall, you have someone to help you get up. You can stay warm on a cold night. I went into hypothermia once camping. Fortunately, I had Debbie with me. And we were able to stay warm on a cold night when I was regressing into hypothermia. You've also got someone who's got your back, too, right? You've got someone, you don't go into certain parts of Chicago without somebody having your back. I learned that quickly, even as we were ministering to gangs and so forth in the greater Chicago area in those 13 years. You need somebody who's got your back. Well, all of these are fruits of true companionship for which we are wired. Most fruitfully, of course, in marriage. Well, that brings us on to verses 13 through 16, point 6. Variety. Some very real-world things that we're dealing with here today, right? There's not a lot of fancy theology in these texts, but real wisdom for living. Verses 13 through 16, variety. We're reviewing a host of profuse evils under the sun. Well, among those profuse evils, the ingratitude of the many for a wise man endures past a fleeting appreciation. Ingratitude seems to outstrip appreciation so often, doesn't it? Koheleth now relates a proverb of a young ex-convict who ascends the throne in the place of an older, foolish king. He's wiser than the foolish king. There seems to be no direct tie to any extant literature in the ancient world, so he doesn't have anybody in particular in mind, although some do see an allusion to the Joseph cycle of stories in Genesis. That is, his ascendancy to the second in the kingdom from prison, right, because of his interpretation of the dreams and so forth, but no direct allusion. But the upshot is the important thing. The brevity of recognition and appreciation, it too vanishes like a mist. Ingratitude seems to endure. Appreciation and recognition vanishes like a vapor, like a mist. And once again, for those of you here for the first time, that's how we translate not vanity and worthlessness and nothingness, but rather brevity. Vapor rather than vanity. My favorite contemporary example is one who's widely considered to be one of the greatest men of the 20th century, Winston Churchill. He was one of the early warning voices concerning the threat of Nazi Germany. And he was roundly condemned. He was turned out of Parliament and defeated in a bid for Prime Minister. Instead, England followed the policies of Neville Chamberlain, who has become a byword in history for compromise and for appeasement, right? His name will ever be linked with appeasement, and Winston Churchill promised that that would be the case because he was going to write the history. And he did. Consequently, Neville Chamberlain's name is forever linked with appeasement. We have film of his return from Germany waving that piece of paper declaring peace in our time. When war was just around the corner, that will always stand in stark contrast to Churchill's resolve to fight in the beaches and on the streets, right? And it's widely acknowledged that almost any other prime minister would have gone the way of the French. That is, surrender. Surrender to the Germans and set up a puppet government. Instead, Churchill rallied not only England, but the entire free world to stand against Germany. What was his reward? A parade down 10th Street, 5th Street in New York? Huh? hero's accolades, perhaps? Perpetual re-election, certainly, as Prime Minister of England? No, it wasn't. He was turned out of office the very term following the war. It wasn't until almost a decade later that his labors began to be appreciated by the English people. As well, in our own history, from my own personal perspective, I think Ron Paul should have been the Republican nominee in 2008 and then again in 2012. What a different country we would be if Ron Paul had been president during those 8 years instead of Barack Obama. Audit the Fed, right? Cut spending. Stay out of foolish wars. All of which we have hurtled into in the interim. Well, the greatest example of one such king, of course, is our Lord Jesus Christ, who at the outset of his ministry met with this kind of response too, didn't he? When Jesus had finished these parables, Matthew relates to us in chapter 13, when Jesus had finished these parables, he went away from there and coming to his hometown, he taught them in their synagogue so that they were astonished and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things?" And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his hometown and in his own household." And he did not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief. Dear brothers and sisters, the days are already here, as this prophet is being ignored once more, is he not? We pray for revival. There must, if there's going to be a reformation, if we're going to make America great again, we have to make America good again first. That is a revival and reformation in the hearts and minds of the American people before there will ever be greatness returned to America. But in the long run, that is vaporous too. That doesn't mean we don't labor, we don't work, but it is vaporous too. Because this Lord Jesus Christ nevertheless stands ready to comfort the afflictions of his people and do so on an eternal basis. Jesus went through all the cities and villages. Matthew tells us this also. Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them. Ergo, the compassion for suffering and for oppression and for against oppressors, too. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless. Oppressed, maybe? Like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Are these vapors, did you resonate with any of these vapors here today that were articulated in these 6 points? So many of them are vapors, are they not? Well, come to the Good Shepherd today. He bids you to come to him. His encouragements, his compassion are eternal, and they are restorative to your soul. You will not find this anywhere else but in the Lord Jesus Christ. Let us now come to him. None. Let us now come to him as we find him in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.